Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, today's date is May 8, 2024. This panel of the court today has five cases on its calendar or agenda, three of which will be submitted with oral argument and two of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. I will call the first case. The first case is number A23-1093, Save Indus Group and Others versus Independent School Districts 363. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal argument of 5 minutes. We have one preliminary issue that was brought to the court's attention. Appellant's counsel would like to display a large poster, and I referred to what I believe are the applicable rules, and I shared them with other members of the panel, also shared them with both counsel. Have I correctly understood, Mr. Tanik, that you wished that you have one large poster that you'd like to show?
Yes, it's one large map of the area, which I think helps visualize this situation a little bit better than I can articulate it. It also is in our addendum. It's addendum A. I did provide it to counsel. I provided the court. I overlooked rule two of the oral argument rules. I looked at rule 13407, and I was not aware that we had a presented before 2 days before, and that was my oversight. But we would like to have that displayed if possible.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tanik. Counsel for respondent, Mr. Davidson, does respondent have a position on the matter?
No objection to the exhibit, notwithstanding special rule practice number two, the 2 days notice not being followed, Judge. It is addendum A. It's part of the court's record. It may be of assistance to the court, so respondent said no objection.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Davidson. So in light of that, then we will allow it. You may set it up before you begin your argument. Is that your preferred location and position, Mr. Tanik?
Yeah, that's probably okay. It's easier for the court to see that. That's fine.
And we do have, each member of the panel has
right.
has it on paper as well. Okay, with that, counsel for appellant, you may again, please, for the sake of our audio record, please identify yourself and your clients, and then you may begin.
Thank you. Again, I apologize for my oversight on rule two. Thank you for your indulgence, court, your honors, and thank you, Mr. Davidson. My name is Marshall Tanik. I represent the appellant, a group known as Save Indus Group, and one individual parent in that school district. As the court is aware, this case concerns the schoolhouse closure law, Min Stat Section 123B.51, Subdivision 5. There are two pre-K-12 schools that have been in this district, South Cochise District 363, going back to the late 1970s. There's one in North Home and one in Indus. They are located about 82 miles apart, although I think it's noteworthy and reflected somewhat in the visual that many of the families and students in the district live in the northern and northeastern part of the county. Way up here, the northern part. So much of the school population comes from an area that's actually north of Indus and even further from North Home. But there is an 82-mile distance between the two schools. But in fact, much of the school population is up in at least 100 or more miles away from North Home. And that's a factor that we think ought to be taken into account as we address it in our argument. As the court is aware, the statute, which doesn't come up too often these days, there was a lot of this type of litigation back in the 80s and 90s when schools were consolidating. There hasn't been much litigation as more lately under that statute, but there are two elements to a warrant closure of a school. The statute refers to necessity and practicability. Neither of those is defined in the statute, but necessity, as commonly understood and as set forth in Black's Law Dictionary, means some kind of compulsion, an urgency, a no-choice situation. We don't think that exists in this situation here, and therefore the necessity element is not satisfied, nor is the practicability element of the statute satisfied. Both have to be satisfied in order to warrant the school, the closing of the Inda school. We maintain that neither of them is. One of the...
Can I just jump in for just one question? For big picture, you do argue in your brief that closure was not a necessity, and you also argue that it was not a practicability. But on our review, that's not really our question, is it? Isn't our question whether there was substantial evidence to support the school district's decision on those two issues?
Well,
given the deference to the
The court doesn't look at this de novo, but this is a certiorari proceeding, so we're aware that the standard of review for certiorari it looks at whether there was substantial evidence or whether the decision was unreasonable or contrary to law and the usual certiorari standards. However, we do note in our brief that this situation, because it's a school closing, and insofar as school education has been deemed a fundamental right in the Skeen case and other case law here in Minnesota, we think that there ought to be some type of heightened or closer look at the record here, rather than simply saying, well, was there substantial evidence for the school board? We think that you ought to take a real drill down as to what the evidence really reflects here, because...
And what would be the legal support for us taking a heightened standard of review?
Well, as I said, the Skeen case indicates, or it doesn't indicate, it states that education is a fundamental right. I think that elevates the type of concern that ought to be addressed in this case.
Understood, but is there a case that supports the idea that somehow, because it's a matter of school closure versus some other public decision by an elected board?
No, there's no case law to that effect yet, although I think this court should just take... I'm just pointing out that because of Skeen and because of the fundamental nature of the right of education in Minnesota, I think this case requires the court to take a deep, close look at the evidence that was presented to the school board.
And just to be clear, obviously the constitutional provision and Skeen were in existence. Well, at least the constitutional provision was in existence before all of these Supreme Court opinions interpreting the statute, but the Supreme Court has never taken that approach, have they?
It hasn't been addressed, no, it hasn't. I don't know, we're raising it here and asking the court to at least take that into account. We think that one of the fundamental defects in this proceeding below was the assumption that one of the schools has to be closed, and presenting this as a zero-sum game, which it's not. We maintain that both of these schools can and should remain open for at least some time period while a more thorough, thoughtful undertaking can be done. One thing that really distinguishes this case from the other school closure cases that this court has addressed is the haste with which this proceeding took place. There was a bond vote in May of 2022 in which the community voted in favor of a $5.5 million bond. That vote, however, was set aside because of some procedural defects in the notice and absentee ballots. And that was in May of 2022. There was no further discussion. The issue of the school closing, however, did not come up until March of 2023. That's when the school board first raised the issue or notion that of closing the Inda school. And a hearing officer then conducted a hearing in April. He issued a report at the end of May, and the school board adopted that report, or the recommendation, on June 14th. The entire process took about 3 months. In looking at other cases, school closure cases, we see a much more deliberative, thoughtful process that involves broader members of the community and outside and information and data gathered from outside sources, which isn't true here.
Does the case law suggest that there's a that the timing, the amount of time that the board undertook in making its decision bears on our review?
I think it can bear on your review. The case law doesn't address that particular issue, but what the cases do indicate is that when the school board goes through a meticulous, thoughtful process, as it did in the Duluth case, as it did in the Yellow Medicine case, as it did in the Roseville case, Kelly case, as it did in the Stillwater case, as it did in the Moberg case, Robbinsdale, all of those cases involved a thoughtful process that took many months, in fact, in some cases, years, in which the school officials engaged the community in lengthy discussion, fact gathering, data gathering, and community involvement in that decision making. Here, that wasn't done. It was a rush to judgment. And because of that haste, many factors were overlooked, not taken into account, or distorted, including many of the key factors regarding pupil enrollment and financial considerations. And those seem to be the two underlying considerations that the board relied upon in its closure decision. One of the facets was the projection that school enrollment will decline to such an extent, particularly in the Indus area, that it wouldn't be feasible to keep both schools open. Those projections were based on some assumptions, some speculations, and some incorrect information. In fact, what occurred is that the superintendent who made the presentation cherry-picked a particular year to compare enrollment in the district with other years. And the school district relied upon the high water mark of enrollment when, in fact, enrollment has been quite stable over a long period of time.
But the county's population has been decreasing over the past two decades, though, correct?
There has been a decrease in
as
population.
As well as the number of students that are enrolling as well.
Well, in 2016, the district had 271 students. In the last year, 2022-2023, it had 270 students. So there had been a decline of one student. And in fact, the figures used by the district did not include pre-K, there's about a dozen pre-K children in the school district too. So actually, compared to about a decade ago, the enrollment has been stable or actually has gone up. In one particular year that the school district cited, the enrollment was down, and that was, as I said, cherry-picked. But in the totality of the last decade, the enrollment has been fairly stable. One reason for that, Judge, is that a significant number of the a significant portion of the student body comes from outside the district. They're open enrolled. It ranges from up to 50 to 60% of the student body come from outside the district. And that contributes to a significant portion of the enrollment. And that's and suggests that it's distorted and really not relevant. I wouldn't say not relevant, but it's not terribly probative to look solely at the population decline when much of the student body comes from outside the immediate area.
How does our standard of review impact your argument that the school district relied upon the wrong data, found the wrong data reliable?
Well, it shows that there wasn't substantial evidence to support the school district's decision. It shows that there was evidence that...
But the school district relied on other data, and you're saying it was the wrong data, there was reliable data. Trying to see how that argument squares with our standard of review.
Well, incorrect data would not constitute substantial evidence. Substantial evidence would require some kind of real...
Well, the determination of when you say incorrect data, the determination of which data is reliable is usually a matter left for the school board, and our standard of review, I think, usually asks the question, well, is there substantial evidence, not was some evidence more reliable than other evidence?
Well, we're not asking to weigh the evidence. We're pointing out that there was evidence that the school board either ignored, bypassed, or disregarded altogether, and that's the actual population figures, the actual enrollment figures. It chose to pick one particular year to cherry pick without taking a look at the actual enrollment over time. So to the extent that the school district's decision is relies upon declining enrollment, it was wrong. It was incorrect in the record. The record showed that that evidence was not there and incorrect, or one could look at it from a different.
And what evidence are you pointing to, to rely on to say that the school district relied on the wrong evidence?
Well, the school district's presentation, the superintendent used those figures from one particular year to suggest, not only to suggest, to advocate that there was a decline in enrollment. In fact, the evidence that was presented to the district.
From whom?
From an outside forensic auditor who was hired by members of the community. Her name was Miranda Kuechel.
And hired by Save Indus?
Yes, she was working for there. She was brought in by them.
Right.
She presented that evidence, which was not really disputed. It was presented as evidence in the proceeding, but it was ignored and bypassed.
Right, but to Judge Ross's point, I think the issue here is whether or not the school district had evidence to support its decision, and we generally defer to the agency or here the school district's decision as to what evidence it would rely on. So, it's basically up to the district to decide which information is reliable and is not. And so we can't second guess the school district's decision.
Well, if the data that's relied upon is defective, incorrect, inaccurate, then it's not substantial evidence. It is evidence that it shouldn't be taken into account at all.
And that's certainly a valid point. Sorry, counsel, but yeah. It sounds like you're saying that they should have looked at this evidence versus the evidence that they relied on. And in terms of what evidence to consider, that's up to the school district to do, right?
Well, we're not saying that they should have relied on only our evidence. We're saying that our evidence was not controverted by them. They relied upon incorrect, inaccurate evidence. They presented data that was not true. It wasn't correct. It wasn't accurate. So to the extent that the school board relied upon that, that can't constitute substantial, meaningful evidence at all. It's inaccurate. It's incorrect. It's defective evidence. Furthermore, one could look at it from another prism of a certiorari review, which is whether the decision was reasonable or not. That is part of the certiorari review. And a court can look at whether a decision like this was made reasonably or unreasonably. There is substantial deference, and the reasonableness standard connotes substantial deference. But nonetheless, if a decision is unreasonable, if it's based on inaccurate, defective information, then it wouldn't satisfy the certiorari standard.
You've asked us to depart a bit from the usual norm in these cases, given the significance of the what's at stake. I'm curious, what would be the rule of law that we would, if let's assume we agree with you and we're going to issue a precedential opinion, what would be the new rule of law that sets this case as the standard on the issues?
Well, we're not really asking for a new rule of law, Your Honor. What we are saying is, because education is a fundamental right, I think it necessitates or warrants this court taking a very close look at the evidence, rather than simply saying, well, there was some evidence before the school board. We don't know if that evidence was correct evidence. We don't know if that data was right or wrong, but we're just going to defer to them anyway. So we're not asking for a new rule of law. We're just asking the court to take a close look at what is in the record, what is accurate and what's not, and determine whether the school board seemed to impose a decision based upon its will rather than a reasoned judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tanik. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please begin by stating your name and the name of your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is William Davidson. I represent the respondent, Independent School District Number 363. On behalf of the district, we are, and the elected school board, we're asking this court to affirm the decision that was made here. As I read the briefs and as I review the issues, Your Honors, there appear to be two, perhaps three issues. One issue initially raised was the standard of review. I believe that the Skeen argument has essentially been foreclosed or waived based upon what I heard in oral argument and what I read in the reply brief. The standard of review by this court, has been clear by this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court. The real two issues in this case are whether there was compliance with the statute in terms of the statutory requirements being met in terms of the notice provided. And then more directly, the main issue is whether there was substantial evidence to support the district's position. Very briefly as to the notice issue, although it was not addressed here today, notice was provided here. There were two separate notice publications provided. Admittedly, the first publication had a mistake in which county was identified, but the actual time and place of the hearing, which the statute requires, and the location of the schoolhouse where the public hearing would be held was accurately reported in both notices. And so based on this court's case law in Benna and in the other cases we've cited, we believe that the statute was complied with and substantial notice, if not actual compliance with the statute, was met here. Due process was not violated in any way, shape, or form. The public knew about this hearing. The public appeared at the hearing. They were heard. And the hearing officer himself found, I believe it's at paragraph 3 in his conclusion, paragraph 1, that there was no confusion in terms of the notice. The more important issue, Your Honor, is whether or not substantial evidence on this certiorari appeal exists to support, in this case, an elected school board's decision. In other cases, it would be an agency's decision. And we contend that there is substantial evidence. As this court is well aware, there has to be more than a scintilla of evidence. There has to be a reasonable mind might accept the evidence presented to support the conclusion drawn. And we believe that that does exist here when you consider the evidence in its entirety.
Could I stop you just for a minute, Mr. Davidson? So is it clear from the Supreme Court's case law that the appellate courts should review in a substantive way the issues of necessity and practicality or practicableness?
This court should review the decision made by, in this case, the school board as to whether substantial evidence exists. It is not this court's view. I don't believe this court's role to act in a de novo capacity, fact-finding in any way. More importantly, it is to defer to those decisions of, in this case, an elected school board, unless there's a showing of arbitrary and capricious conduct, which has not been argued in this case, a showing of fraud, which has not been argued in this case, or if there is an utter lack of substantial evidence to support the decision. And that's the crux of this case. Is there evidence that exists to support the decision, that a reasonable mind could support the conclusion that was drawn? And in this case, it's akin to this court's review of a jury's finding, a finder of fact's decision below. This court would not substitute its judgment for a finder of fact, whether it's a jury or a judge in a bench trial. So too, this court should not substitute its view and in fact should give deference to the decision maker, in this case, the elected school board members.
Is there case law to support that direct correlation between clearly erroneous fact-finding review and substantial evidence review?
Not that I've seen, Your Honor. It just strikes me it's very akin to that type of role that this court would play in perhaps a more familiar setting. And counsel is right in the sense that there have not been hundreds and hundreds of school closing cases. I will point this court, recognizing it was not cited in our brief, it's not like school closing cases do not arise. This court cited the 2017 case from this court involving Stillwater, 834 Voice versus ISD number 834. But also in 2019, this court, and I think a couple of the members of the panel, were on this case involving the Rolling Stone Community School, that's at A18-0799. Minnesota Court of Appeals decision from April 15th of 2019.
So under that standard of review, the substantial evidence standard of review, the question of what's the meaning of practicability, does that come into, is that part of our analysis? If we were to look, for example, at the distance that, might result arguably in a hardship to some families and parents because of the extra traveling that has to occur to get all the way to the remaining school. Is that something that factors into our analysis? If not, why not?
With respect, Your Honor, I don't believe it does. And I think the reason for that is that type of weighing of the evidence, that type of balancing the factors in mind, whether it's distance, whether it's cost, whether it's trends. That has been vested by the legislature under 123B.51 subdivision 5 in the elected school board.
What about the meaning of practicability?
The practicability, that is for the school board to determine whether something is a necessity, or in this case, a practicability, and whether there's substantial evidence to support that. They could not decide that on a whim. They could not just decide based on no evidence or a lack of any substantial evidence that decision.
The school district then, I gather, is arguing that it's not our role, or that we're not allowed to weigh in on the merit to the practicability decision?
With respect, Your Honor, that is correct. That is the district's position. And I think that's consistent with this court's past decisions, as it addressed in Benna, as it addressed in the 834 voice case involving Stillwater, and even as this court commented in the Rolling Stone case. So this court gives substantial deference to the elected decision makers, and its role is limited. Was the statute complied with? We contend it was, in terms of the notice. And is there substantial evidence to support the decision? But not whether this court would make a different decision. I apologize.
But can we still look at whether or not the decision is reasonable?
You may look at whether or not it's arbitrary or capricious, or if it was so unreasonable as to rise to that level, Judge. I don't believe that in looking at that, however, you should not accept the invitation, it sounds like from appellant, to in effect go through a back door and substitute what you would have decided if you were the decision maker. As appellants seem to be doing here, they are in effect second guessing the decision, a very difficult decision that the school board believed it had to make, and that based on the evidence it did make.
Well, I guess I didn't interpret appellant's argument in that fashion. I think that case law and the statute allows us to look at whether the decision in fact was reasonable. So for example, you point to the fact that the schools are only 82 miles apart, which is roughly hour and a half drive one way. But that's just going from school to school. That's not taking into account where the residents live. And if more of the residents are living further away, I mean, it looks like it could be 2 to 2.5 hour drive for a number of students.
It actually could, Your Honor, and I will just simply note, Your Honor, to address it. That is part of the hard decision that the elected school board members undertook in this case. And they did look at that. They did hear evidence as to that. They took that into account. And in fact, what I find interesting, Judge, you know, we're hearing about the different enrollment figures and the like. The board was also aware of the enrollees in the district, the total enrollees in the district. Many of them are open enrolled from other school districts, International Falls, or to the west of the northern part of this school district. And in fact, the projection in 2023-2024 was that of the 177 estimated enrollees at North Home, 92 would have been district residents, whereas the 88 estimated enrollees up at Indus, only 17 would have actually been district residents. The vast majority would have been from other districts. And so I think the school board was allowed to take that into account. Perhaps that, you know, addresses some of the concerns, but as well, the school board took into account that had the roles been reversed, had Indus stayed open and North Home been closed, more students would have been traveling that same 2.5 hour commute from the southern part of the county school district up to the northern school. And as a practical matter, of the two schools, only North Home has the capacity to house all of the district residents. Indus would not have. And so when you weigh in the transportation costs, both the costs and also the inconvenience, the school board took that into account.
I want to ask about some of the numbers, because some of the numbers don't seem to add up. Why doesn't that make the decision not supported by substantial evidence?
Well, with respect, Judge, I'm not quite sure which numbers don't quite add up, but why it doesn't matter is that there is uncontested that there were real financial concerns here. The district, I believe in the appellant's brief at page 9, they said that the financial concerns that the district was facing are real. Now, they put it into context, no doubt, and they themselves attack some of those findings. But for 8 of the previous 9 years, this district was operating in deficit. The only year it didn't operate in deficit was the COVID year when additional funds came in and the schools were literally closed, and so therefore the expenses went down. This district, the trends are unmistakable, and that the numbers do add up there. The enrollment figures are dropping, Your Honor.
But I was a little concerned about the fact that the numbers that were presented were the general fund balance numbers rather than the net. I mean, because ultimately, you really should be looking at the net. And it just seems odd to not have those particular numbers to see where the school district is ultimately sitting from a financial position. Why isn't that insufficient evidence when you're just looking at these general numbers here?
Sure. And Your Honor, I think again that that is asking this court with respects to substitute its judgment if it were a
board
member.
I'm not talking about substituting judgment. I've got a business background. I'm used to diving into numbers, and it seemed to be lacking detail here when you don't have those net numbers there. Why? I think that goes to the issue of whether or not there's substantial evidence to support the decision.
And without getting into the nitty-gritty, Your Honor, of the actual what those net figures are, I'm ill-prepared to address that. But I will say that it is very clear for the 8 of the preceding 9 years, this district was operating in deficit each year. And that when you compared the operating costs of each of the two schools in the number of pupils, the foregoing or ongoing maintenance costs that were expected, both schools were going to require some significant capital improvements, $2 million at one, $1.7 at the other. And by consolidating the district into one school, there was going to be overall cost savings. Whether that's the net figures we're talking about, Judge, or the specific nitty-gritty, I can't say. But there is substantial evidence here, and there was presented and accepted by the elected board members.
If the school district has been running a deficit for 8 or 9 years, why is it that it was only at the earliest April of 2023 that this discussion of school closure came about?
Well, I think that's perhaps a misnomer, Judge. I cannot speak in the record as to whether or not school closures earlier were considered. I believe it was, but it's not in the record. I can speak to the fact that there were attempts to reduce costs that were addressed. To the question that appellant has raised, what about the alternatives that were considered? What about this? What about that? Why can't you do this? One, with respect, that's an argument to be made and was made to the elected school board members. Two, alternatives were considered. In 2020, proposals were made to try to reduce the staff size. In 2022, alternatives were proposed. In 2023, as part of this school closure, to the board itself, the superintendent proposed other alternatives other than closure. The school board looked to and finally rejected those and looked to school closure, and that's its right. It's their judgment call to make as the elected school board members. So the suggestion that this came out of the blue, I don't think is supported, but more importantly, ultimately that's a judgment call that the legislature has vested in the school board. 123B.51 subdivision 5, to the timing issue, if the legislature wants to say, no, you have to provide a year's notice or 2 years' notice, as is often been historically the case, the legislature can do that. It has not done so. It provides a notice requirement. It provides a public hearing requirement, and it requires the substantial evidence necessity and practicability requirements.
I had a question about the general fund. I understand that if it goes down to a certain level, then the state might take control of the district. And what is that level? Is that a matter of statute? Or
I believe it's a matter of statute, Your Honor. Off the top of my head, I apologize. But the school board projected that if the trends continued here, if both schools remained operating, deficits continued, in 4 to 5 years, it would drop below a certain level. And I think it's either a statutory percentage based upon rule or vice versa, Your Honor. But we were not quite in statutory operating deficit yet. But once there, the Minnesota Department of Education would take much more control of the district.
And one more question on that point, and that is, does the current fund balancing, I understand there was a bond issue recently for the sake of some capital improvements. It sounds like the hearing officer, I think, said bonds were issued, presumably money was received. So does the general fund now include monies that's basically committed to be spent on those capital improvements? And if the improvements are not made at Indus, then is there an obligation to to refund the money to bondholders or what?
Apologize, Your Honor. I'm not familiar with the specifics of that, and certainly post this decision, what has happened since then, I'm just not prepared to address, so I'll.
Okay, maybe what about the first part of my question?
Sure.
Does the general fund now include the monies that were raised in the bond issue?
Recognizing, Judge, I think we're talking about two different bonds. One was a bond that passed but then was set aside due to some concerns about voter issues.
I'm
those
not
funds
about
were not
one.
Received. I think the Clean Air Fund bond, if that's the one we're talking about, I believe those did come into the district and are available to be spent, capital expenditures that the district is authorized to spend and authorized by the bond. How that changed the actual balance, whether that bumped it on up or whether those funds have been expended since, I'm just not sure, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Davidson. Mr. Tanik, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. Pardon me. Thank you. I think really what it comes down to is the school board, school district rather, is really asking this court to rubber stamp its decisions without really taking the kind of hard look that it should have taken and that this court should take. I also think there are some legal issues here beyond just saying, well, there is substantial evidence, therefore the school, we can't review the school district's decision. Whether it was practicable or whether it is practicable to close the end of school raises a legal issue that this court has to address. Was it practicable? Given the evidence before the school board,
when you say it raises a legal question, if the legislature hasn't defined practicable, doesn't that suggest that it's up to the elected officials to determine what is practicable under the circumstances in the district?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's a lot of statutes that have phrases in there that the courts have to interpret. And practicability is for this court to determine. Given the record before the school board, was it practicable to make that decision? That's a legal question. It involves some factual determination, but practicability is a legal issue.
So if it's a legal issue, what would be the, again, assuming we were to issue a precedential decision in your favor, we would define practicability how exactly?
Well, practicability can be looked at as is it a decision that makes sense? Is it reasonable? That would be a dictionary definition of practicability. Is it reasonable? Is it something that can be effectively, is it a functional, effective decision? And we believe it's not for a number of reasons. I just want to circle back to Judge Ray's point about the distance here. I made this point, Judge picked up on it too, but by closing the end of school, all of these students living up in this area are going to have extension up one amongst them, not just the 1.5 hour drive to school, but it's obviously a two-way commute. 3 hours will be spent minimum by all of these students up in this area. There's, and all the families are going to have their students going, they continue to go to North Orange, and they have a 3 hour daily commute minimum, but actually it's going to be closer to 5 hours. It's about 120 to 125 miles. Most of the students drive. 125 miles each way, that's 250 miles a day, that's almost a 4 or 5 hour bus ride for these students. That's not practicable as a matter of fact, nor as a matter of law. Likewise, the necessity issue is lagging here as well. In fact, as counsel indicated, the superintendent stated that there's at least a based on the school district's own projections, the deficit issue will not really come into play in terms of a statutory default for some 4 to 5 years. Now, we're not saying once you close the one's eyes and put their head in the sand, ignore that. But nonetheless, when they're saying we're going to have a problem now, and this problem is really going to be magnified in 4 to 5 years,
well,
we don't know that for sure because of
projections. When you say magnified, I mean, isn't it magnified before default? That's...
Well, there's a problem.
You stepped off the cliff after you get to the default.
Well, yeah, we recognize that. We recognize, and we say in our brief on page 9, there is a financial issue here. There's a financial problem. We're not ignoring that, but the school district says we're near the end of a cliff. We're approaching the end of a cliff, but we're not going to fall off the cliff based on projections, which could change too, for 4 to 5 years.
So then what would be import of that? The decision can be made to close a school within 2 years, within 3 years of the default?
The import of that, we believe, Your Honor, is that when we're being told that the danger mark is going to come in 4 to 5 years, that doesn't mean we shouldn't take some action now, but it does suggest that there's no necessity. Necessity is defined, as I said, in Black's Law Dictionary, something that's compulsory, no choice. There's a choice. There's a lot of choices. There's a lot of alternatives over the next few years that can be addressed. Again, not to ignore the problem, but to recognize that we're not at the precipice yet. And there's a number of alternatives, including reissuing, having the bond issue presented to the voters again. As is indicated earlier and is in the record, the voters did approve a $5.5 million bond levy. The school, it was overturned because of these procedural defects, but the school district made no effort to revive that and put it on the ballot again. That would solve the problem. It would have solved the problem had it passed. But the school district had that alternative available to it. It could have put the bond issue before the public, and it did not do so. One of many alternatives that were bypassed here, which we argue would reflect not only a lack of practicability, but no necessity given that and other alternatives as laid out in our brief.
Although your time has expired, may I inquire with one?
Of course, Judge Ross.
Just one quick question for you, Mr. Tanak. Your clients have explored now and are obviously endeavoring to address this matter with a judicial challenge. Are there any political options available, or is this the only opportunity for your clients to keep the school open?
Well, I guess there's always political alternatives. I suppose one could, if a different school board were voted in and they made a different decision, they could probably change their mind, I suppose. But it doesn't seem very practicable to happen at this point. We think it's a legal issue that ought to be addressed by the court. I should note that the vote here, there's 6 members of the school board. I don't know why they have 6, but they have 6. And it could have been a tie vote, but it wasn't. But all 4 of those members who live in North Home voted to close Indus. The 2 Indus people voted not to close Indus. And of course, we have a substantial number of members of the community from Indus here who are very concerned about this. And I should just note that these school closing decisions are difficult. They have devastating effects on communities, especially small communities, where schools mean so much to not just to the education of this parent of the students, but to the community activities and values and business activities in the community. And closing a school district closing a school is devastating. These people feel they've been devastated by the decision, and they ask this court to reverse that decision, remand it, and have the school district reopen Indus and proceed along those lines. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tanak. Thank you to both attorneys. The issues were well and thoroughly argued, and now the case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.